Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today, Thursday, April 26th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. We can do it. Just visit norml.org to get involved. Because of the breaking news today, we're going to shift our John Sinclair interview to next week. Let's get to breaking news today from Normal in Washington. Breaking news today from Washington, D.C. Normal responds to White House's potent pot scare campaign. Data published this week by the University of Mississippi's Marijuana Potency Monitoring Project indicating an increase in the strength of cannabis's primary psychoactive ingredient, THC, is further evidence of the failure of criminal pot prohibition, according to a statement released today from Normal. Quote, "The federal government spends billions of dollars each year enforcing criminal marijuana laws, and what does it have to show for it? More marijuana users, greater marijuana availability, and stronger pot," close quote, the organization said in its weekly press release. Normal's senior policy analyst Paul Armentano also noted that stronger pot doesn't necessarily equate to more dangerous pot. Quote, "Marijuana poses no risk of fatal overdose, regardless of THC content," close quote, he said. He continued, quote, "In addition, studies indicate that cannabis consumers readily distinguish between high and low potency marijuana and moderate their use accordingly, just as an alcohol consumer would drink fewer ounces of high potency bourbon than they would ounces of low potency beer," close quote. The organization further rebutted White House claims that the availability of more potent cannabis was responsible for the rise in so-called marijuana treatment admissions. Normal stated that the overwhelming majority of young people in the U.S. referred to treatment for marijuana are there because they violated state pot laws, not because they or their loved ones believe that they were suffering ill effects from cannabis. Quote, "In reality, this surge in treatment admissions is an outgrowth of enhanced marijuana law enforcement, not enhanced marijuana potency," close quote, said Paul Armentano. Paul is Normal's senior policy analyst, and we caught up with him today to talk about these White House scare tactics. Paul, thanks for taking time today to weigh in on this breaking news. Let's talk about potency. This is an issue the federal government has kind of been crying wolf about for decades, isn't it?
Well, you know, what's funny is if you say, for instance, Google marijuana potency, you will see that the federal government for about three decades now has been saying that the sky is falling, that marijuana today is somehow 20 times or 50 times or even 100 times more potent than it was the generation before. They said this in the 60s, they said it in the 70s, they said in the 80s, they said in the 90s, and they're saying it today. What's a little bit unique about this latest announcement from the White House is that, in fact, they have some data backing up the fact that average THC potency does seem to be a bit stronger today than it was, say, 15, 20 years ago, that there has, in fact, been an increase. However, there's really no real strong argument that any increase, however small or however large, in THC potency makes marijuana any more dangerous or in any way supports the federal government's position that adults who use marijuana responsibly should be arrested and incarcerated.
And Paul, didn't they used to test a whole lot of ditchweed or wild hemp when they figured potency in the past? You know, so the federal government's perception of marijuana is that it had lower THC than what cannabis consumers were actually smoking.
Well, the early potency numbers that are reported by the federal government from the mid-1970s weren't necessarily looking at ditchweed, but they were testing old weed that had come from Mexico, had sat around a while, and in fact was probably never very potent to begin with and then lost even more potency while it sat in storage. So comparisons that are made to the supposed weak marijuana of the early 70s really need to be taken with a grain of salt, because the marijuana that was being tested, by and large, was not the marijuana that millions of Americans were consuming at that time. However, in this case, the federal government is talking about an increase in potency of today's marijuana compared to marijuana that they were testing in the mid to late 1980s. And I think it's fair to say that at that point they did have enough samples of marijuana to get a fair average. And I would concur with their data that if the data shows from the University of Mississippi that today's marijuana is slightly more potent than it was 10 or 20 years ago, I would think that's a fair assessment, but once again, I would not make the conclusion that they are making that in any way this poses a danger to society.
And Paul, how about this new mantra from John Walters and Volkow that so many more teens are in drug treatment programs for marijuana? Now, you know, we know that the science tells us only about 10% of cannabis users have any signs of dependence, and even those who do don't require medical treatment programs. So rather than alarming, that statement is really an incredible indication of the waste of treatment resources here.
Well, it certainly is. This is a circular argument that is used by the federal government to try and justify marijuana prohibition. The irony, of course, is that the overwhelming majority of individuals who are in treatment for marijuana, per se, are actually individuals that have been arrested, they have been before a judge or a drug court, and the court has mandated that they enter a drug treatment program or that individual will serve time behind bars. Naturally, individuals choose to enter drug treatment. And then when they complete the program, generally they have to pay for it, but when they complete the program, often their records expunge, and that's the end of the issue. So here you have the federal government arguing that somehow today's marijuana is stronger than it's been in the past, and that, in fact, is putting people in treatment for marijuana, when the real truth is that individuals are in treatment for marijuana not because marijuana is any stronger today, but because the federal government is arresting more people today than it's ever arrested.
Paul, we also know that THC is non-toxic. There was a study out to that effect earlier this year we reported on here on The Stash. And also the much-touted drug, much-touted by the ONDCP, Marinol, is 100% THC, and it's prescribed with no harm out there. So marijuana with higher amounts of THC is certainly not dangerous in any way.
No, and some could even argue that a stronger or more potent marijuana is actually safer to the public because people will consume less quantities of it to achieve the same desired results. We know that marijuana users moderate their doses according to the strength of the marijuana they're consuming. In fact, the study we talked about, or that you talked about last week, looking at vaporizing, They found that individuals, when they were vaporizing stronger pot, they took smaller puffs, and they puffed less frequently. That's not a surprise. We have dozens and dozens and dozens of choices when it comes to alcoholic beverages. We can choose the potency of the alcohol we wish to drink. Some people choose to drink beer. Others choose to drink harder forms of alcoholic vodka. There's even alcohol out there that's almost 100% alcohol, such as grain alcohol. Yet people moderate their dosage accordingly. You don't see Americans drinking quantities of grain alcohol the same way they would drink beer. And the same is true for marijuana.
Paul, this seems almost silly for the ONDCP to be essentially highlighting their own failures with marijuana. You know, what do you think they're trying to go for here?
Because the ONDCP has, right now, a generation of Americans, parents mostly, who have a first-hand experience from their youth with marijuana. And in many cases, that first-hand experience was either innocuous or that experience was actually pleasant for them. Either way, the federal government has to convince this generation of Americans that somehow their experience is an anomaly and that the marijuana available today resembles nothing like the marijuana that they were exposed to. The reason the government is saying this is because they are trying to get this generation of Americans to deny their own firsthand experience. And the way to do that is to tell them that the marijuana they were exposed to is not the same marijuana that's available today, when in fact the reality is marijuana today is in many ways a little different than it was, you know, even a few generations ago.
And for those of us seeking legal reform, what should we do to counteract this baseless grandstanding on the part of the White House?
Sure. Well, like I said, it's important for the generation, you know, from, like I said, one or two decades ago, to realize that this is, in fact, a scare tactic. And it's a scare tactic directed toward them. And what also needs to be said is, like what we were talking about before, this idea that stronger potency doesn't mean more dangerous marijuana, and in fact could potentially mean even safer marijuana. As you noted, THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana, is non-toxic, and in fact a doctor can prescribe a prescription pill that's 100% THC, and literally tens of thousands of Americans take that safely every day as well. So this concern about THC content is really unwarranted unless the federal government wants to use this as a platform to reassess their own failures in the drug war. I mean, here they have a plant that for 70 years they have outlawed. They've spent billions upon billions of dollars criminalizing it and driving its cultivation underground. And the end result is they've got stronger marijuana than they've ever had before.
Paul, I want to thank you for taking time to weigh in on this news today.
No problem, Chris.
Many thanks again, Paul, and we'll have more on marijuana potency in next week's Audio Stash. Now, why do people like drug czar John Walters and the head of the DEA, Nora Volkow, why do they rail against marijuana? What makes these federal drug warriors ignore all of the science and make all these false statements to the public? Well, there could actually be a physiological reason, a chemical imbalance in their brain. We discovered some of this when we spoke with Dr. Robert Malamede in October. And because of the news today, it seems like the perfect time to highlight that interview. Today we have the story of real-life zombies. That's right, the real horror out there is the attack of the primitive people. Joining us today is Dr. Robert Malamede, one of the world's top researchers into our endogenous cannabinoid system and the roles and function of our cannabinoid receptors. Dr. Malamede is the former chair of the biology department at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, where he's currently professor of biology and continues his essential and groundbreaking scientific research. Dr. Bob is a regular speaker at Normal conferences and events, and we have links to his homepage, and he's got his own podcast. Check it out. We have links at normalaudiostash.com. Dr. Bob presents a fascinating theory as to why we're locked into a battle over cannabis in America. Some of us are naturally endowed with the correct or even heightened levels of cannabinoids and cannabinoid receptors built into our bodies. And some of us do not have nearly enough endogenous cannabinoids, causing profound individual biological effects, as well as broader social consequences. This perhaps genetic difference could be the subconscious and underlying reason why some Americans are prohibitionist drug warriors and the rest of us are peaceful pot smokers or advocating for reform. Joining us to talk more about the cannabinoid system and the real-life zombies who lack sufficient endogenous cannabinoids and receptors is the good professor himself. Dr. Robert Malamede, welcome today to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a great privilege to speak with you today, Doctor. Thanks again for joining us. Let's talk about our cannabinoid system. First, tell us about the term you use, homeostasis. What is it, and do we all achieve it?
Yeah, homeostasis simply means balance. And the way living things work is that we have all sorts of opposing forces that have to be in balance. And the cannabinoids, it turns out, the endocannabinoid system that we all possess, is a what I call a global regulator of our body's homeostasis, meaning it works in many, many places on many different levels. For example, it'll work within cells, it'll work between cells, and it goes on up and works, you know, between tissues. It controls our hormones. And I now recently have published a paper suggesting that it really involves balance even between organisms. In other words, how people cooperate and interact with one another. So we see this multi-scaled approach to basically balancing energy flow, which is what life is about.
So this is really biology affecting our society.
Well, that's my latest belief, yes. I think that because of how cannabinoids influence our bodies and our minds on so many levels, it's impossible for, since we are all, everybody's connected to their environment and to each other. That's the way life is. And since this is regulating so much of how we think, it's going to influence how we interact and in turn influence things like our society.
This is truly fascinating. Let's talk more about our endogenous cannabinoid system. Does the body produce cannabinoids the same as found in the marijuana plant?
Chemically, the chemical is different, but its ability to interact with cannabinoid receptors is not, you know, is the common denominator there. So we don't make THC per se, but we make other lipid compounds, meaning they're derived from fats, that bind to the THC receptors, as well as having a whole host of other functions. So the endocannabinoid system is a very robust and complicated system that we're really just scratching the surface of, and in doing that, we've found just an amazing wealth of new information and knowledge that's going to have a profound impact on how we develop new drugs and treat people for a whole variety of illnesses.
And in talking about the cannabinoid receptors, Normal senior policy analyst Paul Armentano and I have been discussing a new drug, Rimonabant, also known as Acomplia, that blocks a cannabinoid receptor.
Well, it specifically blocks the CB1 receptor, which is the main neurological receptor. We have at least two different cannabinoid receptors, one of which is mostly immunological, but not exclusively, and the other, which is much more global, the CB1 receptor. And originally that was found in our brains, but we now know that it really permeates our body. It's literally almost everywhere.
And so these CB1 receptors, they're not just in the brain.
Yeah, for example, they're in your skin where they have effects on things like skin cancer. They're in your heart where they help protect against cardiovascular disease. They're around.
What could be some of the effects from blocking these cannabinoid receptors, especially doing it in the long term?
I would think it would be very dangerous, and we have a fairly clear example of what that danger might entail. If you eliminate the CB1 receptor genetically, which you can do by modern biotechnology means, you create what's called a CB1 knockout mouse, and those mice die prematurely. So we need our functional cannabinoid system in order to live our, as healthy a life as we might be able to live.
So, doctor, this sounds like it's all about longevity, one of the current media medical buzzwords. Everyone's looking to live longer and a more healthy life. So let me ask you this. Will smoking cannabis lead to a longer, healthier life?
Well, there have not been explicit studies showing that, so we should be clear on that. What we can do is infer, though, from a variety of means. We know that the cannabinoid system regulates literally everything in your body. And by that, I mean, your cardiovascular system, your nervous system, your immune system, your digestive system, et cetera, your reproductive system. And again, what it's doing is trying to keep those systems in balance. That imbalance means different things for different people. It depends where your starting point is, But what we see in common from all of these cannabinoid activities is that they tend to prevent or minimize the consequences and the development of age-related diseases. And it's these age-related diseases that ultimately are, in fact, aging and associated with illness and death. So the cannabinoids help prevent all of that.
Professor Malamy, there have been a number of recent journal publications pointing to Delta-9 THC and other cannabinoids helping with the treatment and halting the progression of the Alzheimer's disease conditions. One scientist who was involved with these studies even went so far as to say he thought the baby boom generation might have lower rates of Alzheimer's disease diagnosis because they smoked cannabis in the 60s and 70s. Do you think there could be anything to that?
Absolutely. Because, again, who gets Alzheimer's disease? Older people, okay? So this is one of the age-related diseases that I'm talking about. If you look at age-related diseases, what are we really talking about? We're talking about cardiovascular disease. We're talking about immunological disorders like autoimmune diseases such as diabetes, Crohn's disease, arthritis. And then we're looking at cancer itself, as well as the very process of aging. And it seems that they all have an underlying mechanism associated with free radicals, which is also what's at the heart of inflammation. And the cannabinoids, both via the CB1 and the CB2 receptors, have important impacts on those processes, to the point that in, for example, recent mouse studies, they've shown that the cannabinoid system is able to reverse arteriosclerosis in mice. We know that it can really delay the onset of experimentally induced things like multiple sclerosis and diabetes. And the fact that it would exert similar kind of protective effects on nervous tissue has also been known for quite a while. The cannabinoid system not only protects nerve cells from dying, but it also is involved in promoting the regeneration and the relinking of nerve cells, part of the learning process. So the manifestations of this cannabinoid system are extremely broad, and the implications are just really starting to unfold. The biggest problem is the inhibition of exploration, both on a personal and a more official scientific level, that's imposed by the absurd government prohibition.
Doctor, it sounds like marijuana prohibition really is keeping America back from treating some of our most serious medical conditions, especially regarding aging.
I would say that for all of these age-related diseases, the first drug of choice that should be tried should be cannabis or cannabis-related medicines, because we are developing synthetics now, which in many cases may turn out to be very advantageous. But the point nevertheless is that here we have something that has such a broad, far-ranging impact on the way we work. And, one of the truths associated with life is that we're not just like simple little linear paths, but rather we're like this massive network of interconnected biochemistry. And because the cannabinoid system impacts on so many of those body systems, it's a much more holistic way to try and restore balance, which is essentially health. The illness is really imbalance. So I would say that the first thing you should try for any of these age-related diseases, speaking as a scientist, again, I'm not an MD, but I am acutely aware of all the science. That's all I do day and night is read all of this new science that's coming out on cannabinoids. And that would be the drug of choice for so many illnesses because it's very safe and it manipulates the entire gestalt, so to speak, of the biochemistry rather than targeting some very little narrow corner. And then if that doesn't work, then you try some of the more conventional meds and perhaps use them in combination.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Malamede from the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. Professor, it seems like the understanding of the cannabinoid receptors and our endogenous cannabinoid system is going to help us treat humans better medically overall.
Absolutely. Well, you know, being very much involved with the medical marijuana community, I can tell you it has a profound effect on so many people. You know, I teach a course called Endocannabinoids and Medical Marijuana. I taught it since I first moved out here to Colorado to be chairman of the biology department. And, you know, it's so rewarding to see how as you educate people and they start to talk to their family and friends regarding specific conditions, how you can really have a very positive impact. For example, yesterday when I was in my class, one of the students gave a presentation on Parkinson's disease, and she gave that because her father, in fact, had Parkinson's. And after spending a few weeks in the class, she had gone to him and said, "Dad, you should really try this," because he was having a lot of trouble with the meds that he was on and being nauseous and not sleeping and uncomfortable and depressed, et cetera, et cetera. And she basically begged him to try it, which he finally did, and the results have been fantastic. I mean, he's just so much better feeling now than he had been before, and we can understand why that is if you bother to read the science that's out there. It's very clear why this is going to have an impact on so many different aspects of the harm that can be caused by things like Parkinson's, just being one example. But again, in that case, you're dealing with nerve cell death, and cannabinoids protect nerve cells from dying.
We were speaking last week with Mitch Earlywine that science has this negative association with the high of marijuana called the euphoria effect by scientists. Why is this seen as such a bad thing?
Well, let's try and look at what does it mean to be euphoric? What does it mean to feel good? Isn't that what we kind of really try to do? You know, in your normal life, if you're fortunate enough to be a healthy, happy individual with good support structure and families and education and, you know, all of the things that we value in life, you kind of are high, naturally. Well, the cannabinoid system is involved in that process. That's why it has important antidepressive effects. That's why it's involved in making people optimistic. And it's just amazing how it's been demonized, and that's why in a recent article that I published tries to address that kind of paradox. How is it that we have something that seems so good, and yet for so many years we've been told it's so bad? And the conclusion I've come to, and I think it's a very logical conclusion, and has not been really evaluated and tested, but I think it just makes a lot of sense, that we are going to have people in the world who are more euphoric than others. It's just natural. You know, you have an average and you have people above and below the average. And part of that euphoria is going to be attributable to their cannabinoid system. And these people are going to be happy and optimistic and they're going to look forward to the future. And in contrast, people who are deficient in their cannabinoid system, at least with respect to different areas in the brain, because you could be deficient in one area and not in another, but you're going to have people out there who are going to be uptight and depressive and unable to readjust to new information and learn new things, all of the things that the cannabinoid system controls. So it's my contention that cannabinoid deficient people, because they tend to look backwards, because the future holds unknowns and they have difficulty learning, relearning, and adjusting, they're going to tend to look backwards. And people who tend to look backwards look at what's already occurred, therefore they tend to agree with one another. I believe, therefore, they get into power and wind up collecting in the government. So I think we're really involved right now in a very critical genetic battle between cannabinoid-deficient people who are making laws against cannabis and people who are out here using it and who are using it to their benefit. You know, the whole stereotype of people, you know, sitting in their cellar and doing nothing, that's not true. It's people, all sorts of successful people at all levels of our society are using it in a constructive, positive manner, including Nobel Prize winners. So, you know, the government is just so off base, and I think they're off base because they can't help it. They're just broken. I call them the primitive people. I take it a step further. Not only do we enjoy it, it's good for us.
And doctor, is there a way that these cannabinoid-challenged individuals can boost their endogenous cannabinoid levels without perhaps introducing the marijuana plant to their bodies?
Well, I think you're touching on something that's extremely important, and I've seen some benefits to what I'm about to tell you. We make our endocannabinoids from essential fatty acids. And we all hear all the time about the benefits of taking omega-3s and omega-6s and taking the right ratio of omega-3s because we don't get enough of them anymore because of our lifestyle and our diets and on and on and on. Well, if you can't make your endocannabinoids because you're not taking in essential fatty acids, and they're called essential because you can't make them, well, then you're going to be deficient. And people with a variety of illnesses seem to gain some benefit by, if in fact that's part of their problem, by supplementing their diet with essential fatty acids. And I would say hemp oil is probably one of the best ways to do that, in addition to fish oil. But the hemp oil, you can get organic hemp oil, whereas the fish oil that you're getting is typically, you know, going to have some level of mercury contaminants, et cetera, in it. So I think by wisely eating and by supplementing your diet with essential fatty acids, we can make sure that whatever endocannabinoids we can make, we are making, and that's going to regulate things like our levels, our pain levels and our sensitivities to pain and our open-mindedness and how much we're going to be prone to a variety of the pro-inflammatory autoimmune diseases, again, like multiple sclerosis, like diabetes, like Crohn's disease, like arthritis. So, you know, the aging population that we have in this country is going to drive the change because these are the people that are typically voting, our older population. They've gone through life, so they have more money, they have more success, and these are the people who don't want to suffer these illnesses. And as this information spreads, and it is spreading because it's true. You see, that's the difference between the anti-prohibitionists and the prohibitionists. The prohibitionists are lying. The anti-prohibitionists are not only relying on science, but they're relying on their experience. You know, if your parents or your relatives or your friends have a particular illness and they say, hey, you know, I tried this and it really helped me, well, then you believe them. And then if you have something similar, you're going to say, well, you know, somebody I know tried this and they said it really helped them. So this is naturally going to spread. This will naturally win in the end. It's a matter of how strong and how repressive the opposing forces are. And since they're in power, they have a lot of power. But the truth will win out in the end. I'm absolutely confident of that.
So it sounds like these good, healthy eating tips we've heard about in other contexts and were beneficial. We didn't understand the full mechanism as to why they were such a benefit.
And we still fully don't, you know. But the point is, we do know that endocannabinoids are made from essential fatty acids. We do know that absolutely. We do absolutely know the consequences of these endocannabinoids, both on humans as well as a whole variety, a huge, huge literature base of animals and cell culture work that show how the cannabinoids inhibit the development of autoimmune diseases, how they promote survival of nerve cells, how they actually kill cancer cells. I mean, this is mind-boggling. You'd think this would be on the front page of our newspapers. Cannabinoids actually, in a variety of circumstances, have been shown to kill cancer cells. Why are we not investigating that with real vigor? I mean, this is so profound that we have one plant that makes these compounds that have so many positive effects. It's so cheap and it's so safe. Why are we not really, really investigating this with the open-mindedness and the enthusiasm that would be out there if it was anything else other than marijuana that had all of these amazing, healthful, beneficial properties?
And finally today, doctor, the big question again, could marijuana smokers in the end up being more healthy over the long term than those who don't smoke or consume marijuana?
It depends on what they're doing in addition to marijuana smoking. See, it's life, again, is not just like a little single channel that you walk through, you know. It's a very complicated thing. And I would say, and I certainly say this from my own experience, being a marijuana smoker for about 42 years now, a consumer. I don't smoke anymore at all. I either eat or I use a vaporizer because there's negative effects associated with smoking. It doesn't cause lung cancer. That seems to be pretty clear at this point. But it is an irritant. It does probably promote things like emphysema and a variety of other respiratory problems. So smoking, it's not necessarily good for you, and certainly smoking it in conjunction with tobacco probably is not good, and drinking and smoking marijuana together are not good. And, you know, you have to live life and do the right things in life in order to be healthy and alive, assuming that you've been dealt a good hand genetically from the start. But marijuana is one of the contributing positive influences that you can do. For example, in my case, you know, I'm almost 59 years old. Now I have a variety of autoimmune type problems like arthritis, etc. But I run. I go and run regularly, but I smoke before I run. I had GERDs when I had stopped smoking when I first came out here because I was going to not break the law. This was before I got my permit. I developed GERDs, you know, gastrointestinal reflux disease. There's clear literature that shows why cannabinoids inhibit that. Well, I started smoking again. This was, you know, in 2001. It went away. I've never had the problem again. I've also not really stopped again. So here, you know, we have a huge pharmaceutical industry that's making billions and billions of dollars. We have constantly escalating healthcare costs, and we've ignored something that's very inexpensive and can provide a tremendous amount of relief for thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans and people all around the world. It's ridiculous.
Dr. Malamede, I really appreciate your joining us today here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash, and I can't wait to speak with you again.
My pleasure.
Dr. Robert Malamede is one of the world's top researchers into our endogenous cannabinoid system and the roles and function of our cannabinoid receptors. Dr. Malamede is the former chair of the biology department at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, where he currently is a professor of biology and continues his scientific research. Dr. Bob is a regular speaker at Normal conferences and events. We have links to his homepage and podcast at normalaudiostash.com. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow.